20 years ago this week, President George W. Bush opened the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. On his first day in office, President Obama signed an executive order to close the prison, and he continued to speak about it throughout his presidency.
I have said repeatedly that I intend to close Guantanamo, and I will follow through on that.
Guantanamo is not necessary.
I'm going to be doing everything I can to close it.
It is expensive.
We will close the Guantanamo Bay detention camp.
It is inefficient.
That's why I argued that it should be closed throughout my campaign.
But make no mistake, we will close Guantanamo prison.
Guantanamo will be closed no later than 1 year from now.
That is why I ordered the prison at Guantanamo Bay closed by early next year.
But 20 years later, Guantanamo remains open.
It's a failure. The whole system has failed, but it's also a system that is contrary to our judicial and legal values.
What's the point of closing Guantanamo? What's the point? Does the American feel safety? Does it like serve justice? No.
It is no longer an operation where people will, with pride, say, I serve there, I do this.
Guantanamo is a prison for Muslims and only for Muslims. And that is offensive.
I'm Melissa Harris Perry, and on today's episode of The Takeaway, we're spending the entire hour on Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. I started by sitting down with a colleague who helps me understand American military history.
My name is Dr. Earl J. Katagnis, Jr. I'm an adjunct professor of security and risk analysis at Penn State University, Brandywine, as well as an editorial board member for Marine Corps University Press. Guantanamo Bay is not just the detention center, but it's also the naval base.
The U.S. naval base in Guantanamo is a remnant of the bloody Spanish-American War. But when Cuba earned its independence from Spain in 1898, it found itself entangled with the U.S. The 1903 Platt Amendment allowed the U.S. to operate a military base on the island. And the U.S. wasn't just leasing some waterfront property in Cuba for its navy. Guantanamo Bay established a kind of shadow imperial relationship, one where the U.S. partnered with the white Cuban elite to subordinate and oppress Afro-Cubanos. In 1912, the U.S. deployed more than 1,000 American Marines to join armed Cuban forces in quelling a presumed uprising by Black Cubans who resisted the racist, discriminatory policies of the Cuban government. Historians believe that more than 5,000 Afro-Cubans were slaughtered by the Cuban forces backed by U.S. Marines. Now, the Platt Amendment was repealed under President Roosevelt, but America continues to lease the land and station troops at the base throughout World War II. And it wasn't until the Cuban Revolution brought Fidel Castro to power that the base became a point of contention between the American and Cuban governments and a hot spot of the Cold War. While American policymakers speak of closing Guantanamo, what they mean is the 20-year-old detention center. The U.S. has no plans to leave the military base we've occupied for 120 years.
Guantanamo Bay, the detention center, the Office of Military Commissions, the tribunals that occur with the terrorists that are picked up off of the battlefield since 2002, since its opening, there are two different entities, although the military commissions are on the naval base. The naval base is not going to go away. It is a strategic asset. It's right square in the middle of a thorn in the Castro regime's side. It's also a place for drug interdiction operations, a place that will secure our foothold into the Caribbean. And particularly, it's a place that we are not going to give up.
Following the attacks of September 11th, the Bush administration redefined this strategic importance of Guantanamo in terms more sinister than simple geography.
The main reason why the prisoners were taken the way they were is that they were classified in some legal way as enemy combatants, or at least seen in that way.
Gitmo was seen as a space beyond law, where these so-called enemy combatants could be held outside the protections of the Geneva Convention.
Terrorists who once occupied Afghanistan now occupy cells at Guantanamo Bay.
During the past two decades, 780 men have occupied cells at Guantanamo. And of those 780 men, 540 were transferred during President Bush's administration, another 200 were transferred during the Obama administration. At least 30 are known to have died after being transferred, and another 9 men died while in custody. Another 39 are still held. Held, detained, transferred. See, these are easy, clean, sanitized words, but the reality of what happened to those men at that place is far more brutal and gruesome. I talked with someone who's been involved with the prisoners at Guantanamo almost since the start.
My name is Wells Dixon. I'm a senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and I've been representing detainees at Guantanamo for the last 16 years.
So I asked Wells how the detention center has changed since he first encountered it.
Guantanamo is no longer shrouded in complete secrecy. I think it's important to recognize that Guantanamo has failed its essential purpose, which was originally to operate a secret prison outside the law and away from any public scrutiny. The Center for Constitutional Rights challenged indefinite detention at Guantanamo and won at the U.S. Supreme Court in 2004. And the most important part of that victory was the right to go to the base. The other way that Guantanamo has changed in the last 2 decades is that there are far fewer men now detained. When I went to Guantanamo for the first time 16 years ago, it was a massive military operation. There were hundreds of men detained at Guantanamo. You may remember this is the time of hooded men in orange jumpsuits. It was the height of the war on terror. There are a lot fewer men detained now. There are 39 men in total. 27 of them are awaiting transfer. And there are 12 who are involved in military commissions, including one of my clients, Majid Khan, who will complete a sentence next month and need to be transferred. What's also changed in the last 2 decades is that the men are largely ignored at this point by the authorities. When you go to Guantanamo now, everyone sort of goes through the motions. A lot of the men are like ghosts. They're just trying to survive day by day, regardless of whether they're approved for transfer or maybe facing a military commission.
With greater attention, the most egregious abuses stopped. But now Wells sees men transformed into ghosts. 36 in a space built to house 400. Earl Katagnis described the conditions a little differently. He drew attention to the horrifying circumstances of domestic incarceration experienced by American citizens.
The infrastructure of the base has gotten larger and larger, and to the point now where the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay are the inmates treated much better than our prisoners in the United States, our American citizens that are particularly in supermax with the isolation that occurs and some of the pretty dire circumstances and some of the more of the state prisons and the county prisons that we see across our country. So reporters are seeing a very limited view of what they're looking at, but compared to our state prisons and especially some of the county prisons and some of the other real remote areas of our country and even the federal supermax, they're not even equivalent. The access to the legal, to lawyers and to really high-powered lawyers, legal defense is much greater than our American citizens.
Earl's comparison put me back on my heels. It's troubling, but not entirely irrelevant to draw attention to injustices and indecencies endemic in our prison system. Still, the need to confront how we treat American prisoners does not absolve us of the responsibility for addressing the continuing inhumanity at Guantanamo. Here again is attorney Wells Dixon.
Let me tell you about Majid Khan, who is a client that I have represented at Guantanamo since 2006. One thing that's important to understand about his case is this. A jury of senior military officers in his case handwrote a letter to the Pentagon official overseeing the military commissions, and they recommended clemency for Majid. What they said in their letter was that his torture and the denial of due process rights for detainees at Guantanamo is a moral stain on the fabric of America and a source of shame for the U.S. government. This was a repudiation.
Attorney Dixon emphasized that the legacy of torture and abuse are only the most obvious reasons Gitmo must be closed. For him, the very existence of the prison is wrong.
I think it's important to remember that of the 780 men who've been detained at Guantanamo since it opened 20 years ago, all of them are Muslim. Guantanamo is a prison for Muslims and only for Muslims. And that is offensive. It's offensive to me, and it should be offensive to everyone.
Let me just ask this. Has the existence of Guantanamo Bay Detention Center made us more safe during the past two decades?
Guantanamo has not made us safe at all. In fact, quite the opposite.
I couldn't let go of this language and of what it means. Guantanamo is a prison for Muslims and only for Muslims. Guantanamo is a prison for Muslims and only for Muslims. There is no way around this foundational empirical reality that for two decades, my nation has openly operated a prison for Muslims. So I asked what it would take to close the detention center.
Guantanamo has, for those men, really become their forever prison. It's cruel. I don't know how else to say it. It is absolutely cruel. It's playing with people's lives to say, you shouldn't be here, but to continue to detain these men. And I appreciate President Biden's commitment to closing Guantanamo as a policy matter, but his administration has failed to take substantial steps toward achieving that objective. The first thing that needs to happen is the administration needs to stop undermining its own policy closure objective. That is, it has to stop fighting in court to detain people that it doesn't want to detain in a prison that should be closed. The other thing that has to happen is the administration has to put in place the necessary infrastructure and personnel to negotiate and carry out transfers. The remaining military commission cases need to be resolved. There is, at this point, bipartisan consensus that the military commissions have failed to achieve justice for anyone. Can't move beyond the post-9/11 era without closing Guantanamo.
Of course, making this happen is not just a matter of will or strategy on the part of the Biden administration. The American people and the U.S. Congress will also have a role to play. And that, Earl Katagnis warned, might prove particularly challenging.
There needs to be much more public engagement. The Congress holds the purse strings, and that's where money talks and money walks here. So they hold both of those power strings. Every senator or every congressman, if they are in favor of closing down Guantanamo Bay, if you were to ask them where to place those prisoners, they will say somewhere else, not in my jurisdiction, so not in my district or not in my state.
Later in the show, I talk with some members of Congress, and I'll ask them about Earl's analysis. My next guest was imprisoned without charge for 14 of those 20 years.
My name is Mansour Baithi. I am a former Guantanamo detainee, currently work with CAGE as Guantanamo Project Coordinator. Also, I am the author of Don't Forget Us Here. And they used to call me at Guantanamo Smiley Troublemaker, or 441.
Mansour is a citizen of Yemen. He was not captured in battle or identified by surveillance work. There's no intelligence linking him to the terrorist attacks of 9/11. Here is how Mansour came to Guantanamo.
I was kidnapped by one of the warlords. They wanted our car. Then when America came, America started throwing flyers, offering a large bounty for money for anyone who can turn any foreigner people in Afghanistan. I was sold the first time from one lord to another, then sold to the Americans. I was sold as Al-Qaeda general. I was taken to the CIA black side, tortured. I admit to everything. I don't like whatever, because the torture, day and night, weeks, all kind of like, oh Allah. But the problem was giving the details. You didn't have, you cannot give something you didn't have. So I was taken then to Kandahar detention, then shipped to Guantanamo.
As difficult as Mansour's story has been up to this point, it quickly becomes even more appalling. So I want to warn our listeners that what follows includes some graphic depictions of abuse and torture.
When we arrived at Guantanamo, the Marines received us, and they're so professional in their beatings, shouting, screaming, just throw you like a bag from one soldier to another. So when we arrived, they have like called up the process station. when we arrived, like people put us on our knees. You cannot only, you have to sit on your knees. We couldn't because we fell down. They just force you and keep holding you to sit in your knee and beating you with your head down. It's like a way of humiliation and it's revenge or whatever. Like we said this for hours. Then they were dragged, not dragged to a place. I could see like the scissors like cutting my clothes. Like, wow, it was so scary, you know? I'm shackled, hooded, my eyes covered, my ears covered, my mouth duct taped. And they took everything except the hood and the stuff on my face. And I felt water and I felt brooms over my body. It was like on the floor with brooms. I was like, oh, I felt like I was drowning. They were like cleaning us, beating. And I was dragged from one tent to another, from one person to another. Oh, I didn't know what they were doing. And like they dragged me from. It's so humiliating, the search, the abuses. And I was dragged eventually to a cage. At the cage, like they removed the hood, duct tape. Oh, it was painful because they were sitting on top of me, the team, they call six of the guards wearing their armor. The first thing I saw, it was like, I couldn't see anything. It was too bright. I couldn't see that moment. Like, am I dead? Am I in hell? Who are these people? You couldn't see discontinuing faces or like, you know, recognizing faces. All I can see, orange jumpsuit everywhere. You can moving. And everything happening so fast and crazy at the same time. Like even my mind cannot process what's going on, what's going on. Because nobody told me what's going on. Nobody knows what's going to happen. It's just you live in that confusion and fear and, you know, and loss.
This is what was done to a man charged with no crime. It was done in the name of the American people. And we were told it made us safer. Somehow, Mansoor survived what was done to him.
It has been a long and devastating crazy journey, but also there was some kind of moment of joy, beauty, moment of happiness. You know, there was a life at Guantanamo. There was life, love, hope, you know, pain. There was death. We struggled to survive. And we tried as much as we could to stay as we are. But in places like Guantanamo, those places change people. I grew up at Guantanamo from a young boy to a man. I spent around like 15 years in Guantanamo, moving from jail to detention to prison, from hunger strike to torture, abuses. But I never lost hope. You know, too much hope is a problem. Always, I believe that everything in the hand of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala as a Muslim. And no matter what happened to me, you know, I can handle it. I tried. You know, there was some moment you think it's, you know, this is it. Like, I can't move. I can't. No, like I'm giving up. Okay. But in the second day, no. Move. As long as you still live within you, there is a resistance. There is a hope. There is also a way. Just move. Move. Because no one can break you unless you let them. No one can, you know, take the hope unless you let them do it. So it is the key, it's in your hand. We managed to survive at Guantanamo because we had each other. As, you know, that hardship, torture, abuse, mistreatment, that tremendous injustice brought us together, you know, forged some kind of brotherhood, friendship. And the things that, you know, also the feeling of your innocence within you. You know, this also strength, give us strength, because I have done nothing wrong.
And Mansoor did more than survive. Through his resistance to the brutality he experienced and in determination to retain his humanity, he became an advocate.
As a victim, it's like my duty to fight for the injustices and the wrong that have been there. That because as a victim, you should stand. Because you are the one who should tell the people, tell them the truth, and fight for justice.
I want to thank Mansoor Adafi for sharing his difficult but necessary story with us.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
During these two decades, 780 men have been detained at Gitmo, but they are not the only ones forever changed by life inside Guantanamo.
My name is Steve Wood. I'm a former guard at Guantanamo Bay.
After the death of his father, Steve's mother raised him and his brothers in a small town just south of Portland, Oregon. Steve graduated from high school and he worked for a short time in a sawmill, but he wanted to do something that felt important. He wanted to make a difference.
Well, I joined the National Guard in 1999 and basic training in 2000. And after the attacks on 9/11, you know, a lot of the National Guard and reserves ended up going out on active duty. And first I got deployed to Egypt in 2003. And then 2004, around July, my unit got deployed to Guantanamo Bay. After about my third shift, I was actually switched to a special mission. And this special mission was pretty much like a quasi-black site within Guantanamo Bay.
Wood was assigned to Echo Special, a unit whose sole responsibility was guarding a single detainee that he was told was high value. But Wood later came to learn that this wasn't true. In fact, Mohamedou Ould Slahi was first brought to Guantanamo in 2002. And Wood told me by the time they met, Mohamedou was already broken, a brokenness inflicted by the torture he'd experienced at Gitmo.
They treat him like a dog, you know, and there's evil. And, you know, there needs to be accountability for that, for sure. You know, and one of the individuals that was the main guys actually was a Chicago detective who, you know, has a history of being a dirty cop there also, and no accountability at all. You know, we hear a lot about the CIA and what they did and, with like the DIA, you know, they've been the military interrogators. Like, there's a lot more that needs to come out into the open.
Mohamedou ultimately gave information to his interrogators. And as a result, he enjoyed the so-called privilege of somewhat more humane treatment. He was given soap, towels, prayer beads, books, comfort items that are denied to other detainees. It was in this context that Steve and Mohamedou met and began to form something of a friendship.
It was kind of a natural thing. You know, like we were put into this position where we were told this guy was part of Al-Qaeda and he was high ranking, but he is now, you know, giving a lot of information and he's saving thousands of lives. So now we're going to treat him well. So we went in there and like, so we had to get flip the switch. At first it was like an act, but it was natural to just truly become friends and also, you know, start questioning, you know, how the U.S. government's been running things, you know, the conflicts the U.S. has gone into. We're not the good guys, you know, that was the conclusion I came to. And Iraq at the time was all turned out to be based off of lies. I just started questioning everything.
Steve enlisted in the National Guard because he wanted to do work that mattered. And after September 11th, he was proud to be part of a fighting force protecting his nation. But as a Gitmo guard, he started questioning everything.
I went in there, I was highly patriotic and full-on Republican, and we were told everybody in Guantanamo was the worst of the worst. My opinion on that changed really quick. They had underage people there, you know, and they had 80-year-old detainees, and when you saw him face to face, and especially my time with Mohamedou, you know, I was able to like see the human side of these detainees and talk to him and learn from him. And I became friends as much as we could be, you know. And yeah, it definitely changed my views on everything.
Steve began to question the righteousness of the U.S. war on terror. And I asked Steve how raising these questions about his country made him feel.
It was a crazy thought, you know. At first you think it's like, wow, am I a traitor? And you know, these are thoughts that I definitely could not, you know, talk to any other guards about, you know, and so I can't, you know, say if they felt the same way, but it was definitely stressful in the back of my mind, I always had this stress of like, okay, well, what if they're going to tell me to like throw a mask on that, you know, start, you know, cause interrogators want to, you know, change the way they're interrogating them again. And which I would obviously, you know, say, you know, hell no, but then I'd be kicked out of there knowing it's still going to happen. You know, so I spent, you know, that was always in the back of my mind, this like, this anxiety of like, if that was going to happen, you know, it made me angry. And I ended up being antisocial, and like, you know, I would go to, you know, work in Echo Special. And then afterwards I go to the gym and then just go to the you know, the housing and spend time by myself.
After a year in Echo Special, Steve Wood returned home to Oregon, but he was not the same person he'd been before his time in Gitmo. Months of conversation with Mohamedou had begun to shift his perspective on American history, on the world, and on Islam. Steve began to read and study to fill the gaps and to correct the lies he'd once believed. Steve left Guantanamo in 2005. Mohamedou remained. And Mohamedou wrote a memoir, Guantanamo Diary, which gave an account of the gruesome torture he'd experienced. When it was published in 2015, it was so heavily redacted by the American government, it was barely readable. But Mohamedou's lawyers fought a 7-year battle to have him released. And finally, in late 2016, more than a decade after Steve went home to Oregon, Mohamedou left Gitmo. In January of 2019, Steve Wood traveled to North Africa to see Mohamedou for the first time as a free person.
Yeah, when I visited him, that was amazing too. You know, it was like, it made our friendship real at that point, you know? Because before, like, in Guantanamo, like, I was, you know, I was in charge, you know? There was an imbalance in the friendship. So it was like, I know I feel like friends, but, like, it was an official at the bad time. But that visit, it made it official, you know? And it was amazing, amazing experience seeing him and meeting his family. And, like, yeah, it was... And I've been back 2 times since. So, and definitely going to hopefully visit him again.
I asked Steve what the American people need to know about Guantanamo and about what is being done in our name.
I want them to know that it's a dark place, and it was in the past and it still is. You know, in the U.S., like every 4 years we get a new president, and it's like our nation's been baptized, and like everything was the last president's fault, you know, but that place is still open. And Biden, I don't think he's going to close it. And it needs to be closed because it's a black eye, you know, for our nation. And the world, and, you know, the citizens, they need to know exactly what happened there. There's a lot that is still has not been said. And if they knew, and if everybody knew exactly what happened down there, I think people would care. And now that's what it's going to take to close it, I think, is like, everybody to know, understand, and know. So the transparency is so huge and very important.
Now, the only way that we really know what's happening in and around Guantanamo Bay is because of the work of journalists.
I'm Carol Rosenberg, Guantanamo Bay reporter for the New York Times.
Carol's been covering this issue since the beginning. And I asked her to reflect on her first moments covering Guantanamo.
4 months to the day after the 9/11 attacks, a cargo plane landed at Gitmo carrying the first detainees coming to Guantanamo Bay, the first detainees to be held in Camp X-Ray in Cuba. And as it happened, I was there on the ground. We got to watch it as a pool, take notes, and see those first 20 men come off the plane in those orange uniforms that later would become quite infamous and people would see in a photo subsequently released by the Pentagon. I had no idea that it would last 20 years, but I can tell you that I really did feel the weight of history that day as we were watching those men come off the plane. You know, they forbade photography. There was a photographer from the Miami Herald down there. They said there'd be no pictures because I think they were protecting the security measures. They didn't want people to see exactly how it was done, but we could write. And so I wrote in detail what was happening because I understood this was the only public record of what would happen on that day. In a pool report, I described those men coming off the plane one at a time. You know, we hadn't seen the orange jumpsuits in that context before. We hadn't seen prisoners at Guantanamo
Over time, I understood this was kind of an experiment in offshore detention, in what became called the War on Terror, that we were picking people up and moving them 8,000 miles across the globe and putting them in cages. And there was no photography. So I really did feel that it was a writer's story and one I wanted to stay with.
In the 20 years of the existence of the detention center, there have to have been numerous changes. So I asked Carol about the differences between then and now.
It started off as a backwater, maybe about 2,000 people there. And it would be hard to find people in uniform before the detention operation. It was in caretaker status. They kept a very low profile. They didn't want to provoke Fidel Castro. Reporters didn't go there. And it was a sleepy little outpost. Today, it has about 6,000 residents. 2,000 of them are those laborers from the Philippines and Jamaica. It has about 1,500 people assigned to the detention operation of 39 detainees. About 1,000 of them are National Guard who come and go. It's become a really high-tech functioning base. When I first reported from there, there was no internet access. There was very limited communications. And getting a story out involved pulling a telephone line out of the ceiling of the terminal and plugging it into the back of my laptop. The base has evolved along with the technology.
With such a massive operation, I wanted Carol to explain what closing Guantanamo would mean.
When they say closing Guantanamo, they don't mean abandoning the Navy base, and they don't mean letting everybody go or not retaining the right to hold people as prisoners of war. You know, there's only a dozen of them who are charged in the trials. Again, six of them capital cases. And there's a man down there who's serving a life sentence. He has to serve it somewhere. If not at Guantanamo, the idea would be they could move him to a U.S. setting, maybe Leavenworth Prison or a brig somewhere.
But the detention center remains open. And according to Carol's recent reporting, there is a secret courtroom being constructed by the Pentagon. So I asked her about that.
I'm actually really puzzled by this development. I discovered this in the course of working down there. We knew there was a plan to build a second courtroom because there was a desire, perhaps at various times, to hold two hearings or two trials simultaneously. It seems like they think it was expedient and cheaper, but the decision to do that, they really haven't justified this or explained to me why they're doing it, because they just spend, you know, millions of dollars at that compound called Camp Justice every year. It's very difficult to cover the hearing at Guantanamo Bay. And I think the vast majority of Americans think the base is, if not the detention operation, is closed. President Trump reversed the order to close Guantanamo and threw a lot of money at the place, including for new barracks for hundreds of guards, and had intended to add more detainees there, which he didn't succeed in doing. But for some reason, for this one courtroom that could potentially hold a death penalty trial, they decided to do an efficiency thing by not allowing the public to see it. Lots of questions there, very few answers.
When we talk about Guantanamo, we talk about the system. Talk about the base, we talk about the detention center. I wanted to hear from Carol if she's seen a change in the people who serve there and how they are feeling.
It is no longer an operation where people will, with pride, say, I serve there, I do this, and this is my name, and this is my job. Part of that was a decision made by some generals to sort of button down and make the place secret. Part of it was, I think, a conclusion by some people in the Pentagon that transparency wasn't working for them. It was, they didn't feel that they were able to get, as they would call it, the good news of Guantanamo out. And so they felt that they didn't need to be accountable anymore. And I think, as you know, there's almost no reporter who goes down there with the exception of me and a couple of other people. So they kind of managed to depersonalize the place and make it not a story, which is, I think, a shame. Just because people won't put their name and face to what they do down there doesn't mean we shouldn't be asking questions and they shouldn't be accountable for it. So the arc of Guantanamo is people, I'm not sure that they're ashamed of their service there, but they're certainly not allowed to be proud of it anymore. And they're not allowed to be outspoken about what they do.
My thanks to Carol Rosenberg, Guantanamo Bay reporter for the New York Times. Given all that we've learned about the brutality happening inside Gitmo and how little meaningful security it has produced, we wanted to understand why it's still open and what it would take to close it. I began by talking with a congressman from my state.
This is David Price, representative of the 4th Congressional District in North Carolina.
Congressman Price has long agreed that Guantanamo needs to be closed.
Should be certainly clear now, with only 39 detainees left, and we're detaining them at a cost of something like $13 million per year per detainee. You know, we dispose of these cases in one or two ways. We either secure the transfer of these people to their own country or some third party country under very secure arrangements. That needs to be stressed, or we have some kind of judicial proceeding it's not just indefinite detention, but we put them in some kind of judicial proceeding, either the commission or the U.S. criminal courts. The vast majority, if not all, of these cases can be disposed of in these ways, and it should have been done long ago.
$13 million per year per detainee. That's a cost that far exceeds the annual per-person investment made by the federal government in our public schools or in our health care coverage for the poor. And I wondered if this price tag might be the basis for bipartisan support for closing the detention center.
Well, the total cost, the cumulative cost now is over $6 billion. That's just incredible. And the annual cost is $500 million. And the cost, as you say, per prisoner is $13 million. That is hundreds of times more than we pay to house prisoners in our penal system. So you would think self-styled guardians of the federal budget would worry about that, wouldn't you? But I haven't seen much evidence of that.
After my conversation with Representative Price, I turned to another member of Congress.
Congressman Adam Schiff, 28th District, Burbank, California, and I'm chairman of the House Intelligence Committee.
Congressman Schiff told us about other barriers to closing Guantanamo.
There is a process that the Justice Department has used and the Defense Department to methodically go through the circumstances of each detainee and try to figure out what's the appropriate disposition. We've made that more difficult, though, in Congress with provisions in the defense bill each year that make it more difficult for the administration to close down Guantanamo, to make it more difficult to transfer detainees. So I think under the current administration, only one has been transferred to a third country. And we're really not much closer to shutting it down than we were a few years ago.
And I asked Representative Schiff about something Professor Earl Kategnis Jr. told me earlier.
Every senator or every congressman, if they are in favor of closing down Guantanamo Bay, if you were to ask them where to place those prisoners, they will say somewhere else, not in my jurisdiction, so not in my district or not in my state.
There is certainly that political aspect to it. And in fact, when different prison facilities have been mentioned as a potential place to move some of the detainees, it usually raises a hue and cry from that representative. The reality is, though, that our prison system, our federal prison system, including our supermax prisons, have a very good track record of being able to safely detain even the most dangerous people. And so we have the capacity to do it, but you're right. It certainly is a political issue. And it's, I think, part of the reason why it's been so difficult to extricate this language every year from the defense bill that makes it more difficult to either bring detainees to the United States or prosecute them elsewhere.
I wondered if there was any way that seeking to close Guantanamo could be a political asset for a congressional candidate.
I think the argument to be made in favor of shutting it down is that it has, over the years, really undermined our standing in the rest of the world in terms of the rule of law, something that we hold up and espouse as an American value. Guantanamo has proved to be singularly incapable of prosecuting efficiently or effectively the detainees there. It has taken years and years to go through the military tribunal or commission process, and the results have generally been overturned by the courts. So as a institution, it's failed other than to hold people. And so I think the argument is that it is inconsistent with our respect for the rule of law. It has not worked as well as our criminal court system. It's exceedingly expensive. And for all these reasons, we ought to end this remaining chapter of the war in Afghanistan.
For 20 years, we've been operating an institution inconsistent with our respect for the rule of law. Certainly, that has global ramifications.
I think basically just the notion that we are detaining these people at great expense, apart from U.S. territory, in a way that denies the basic premises of our constitutional system, that is a stain on this country's rule of law and the kind of basic rights that anyone who's charged even the most heinous crimes, the kind of recourse they have. And so it remains it's a failure. It's a failure. The whole system has failed, but it's also a system that is contrary to our judicial and legal values. I think the way forward is pretty clear. The demagoguery on this is unfounded. And I think those of us in Congress who understand this it's incumbent on us to keep up the pressure.
And with that insight from Representative Price, we'll bring our show for today to a close, noting even in these final minutes that Guantanamo Bay Detention Center remains open. 39 Muslim men are still held there. Hundreds of American troops continue to work there. And the anguish that we heard today has not ended. You found this hour valuable, and we'll be sure to keep our eyes focused on Gitmo and bring you any developments. Now, I'd like to send a big thank you to all of our guests for today's show: Earl Katagnis Jr., Wells Dixon, Mansour Adafi, Steve Wood, Carol Rosenberg, Representative Adam Schiff, and Representative David Price. And before I head out, let me thank my team, who really did the dang thing this week. Our senior producer is Ethan Oberman. Shanta Covington is our planning editor. Our producers are Meg Dalton, Katarina Barton, Deborah Goldstein, and Joseph Jedian. Zachary Bynum is our digital editor. Vince Fairchild is our broadcast engineer. Jay Cowett is our director, and they both sound designed the show. Milton Ruiz helped us out on board this week. Jackie Martin is our line producer. David Gable is our administrative assistant. And Mary Croak is our executive producer. And folks, let me tell you, it was a hard week and everybody did the teamwork thing this week. On Monday, we're airing a very special Martin Luther King Jr. Day special with help from our friends at WNYC, as well as the Apollo Theater in New York. We're talking about arts and activism and how it inspired the work of Martin Luther King Jr. It's going to be great, so please make sure you tune in. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.